West Virginia mountain melody. There's a new river singing to me. Oh, this time it's wild and free, your West Virginia mountain melodies.
Good day, this is Martha Jett, the host of Around and About the Clarksburg History Museum. And today I'm joined by a very special guest, and I'm just so thrilled to have you at the museum today. And I'm talking about Sam Folio. Sam, welcome to the museum.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here. I'm excited for the museum.
Oh, thank you. I'm so excited to have you here and tell your stories. I was just telling you, I refer to you as a Renaissance man because you've done so many things in your life and so many very different things in your life. So I'm anxious to hear all about that. And you're a Clarksburg native, and I just really think you've had an interesting and blessed life. So I just thought we'd talk about that.
Well, it's not over yet. So
that's right. You still have a chapter to continue. Now, you were born in Clarksburg, correct?
I was born in the what was called the United Hospital Center, but it was Union Protestant Hospital down on Washington Avenue.
Oh, okay.
And my grandmother lived at 158 Washington Avenue. And then there was Hattie Green lived the next house. Then it was the nurse's school where they stayed. And then the hospital.
Oh,
that's
okay.
Right at the bottom of Washington Avenue. And next to that was Melbourne Hall. And then on down, that would be the same place where St. John's Church was in that area.
Now, where did you live at in Clarksburg?
In Clarksburg, well, we started living with my grandmother, and then I guess we lived in Broad Oaks for a while. But my formative years, I lived on Birch Street, and 612 Birch Street. And that's by Mulberry Avenue and Beach Street, and I think the freeway took part of that over by Broadus Avenue and College Street.
Who were your parents?
Mark and Mary Folio. My dad had a business across from the bus terminal. It was called the Interurban. And that's what the bus terminal, they called it, the Interurban. And we had Folio Brothers, which was a store there.
And what did they sell?
Well, they sold, as I remember, we had fruit and had a soda fountain, ice cream, and beer.
That they did a booming business right there by the...
They did, because the trains were running, the buses were running, and the streetcars were running. Because I recently went up to Washington, PA, to the streetcar museum.
Yeah.
There's a beautiful streetcar museum up there, and a local former eye doctor here is one of the hosts up there, and he drives the tour bus up there and everything, and so I went up to see the new facility. It's I guess it's a $4 million facility, and saw the streetcar that I used to ride.
Oh, you're kidding!
It's there.
What a coincidence!
It's there, and that streetcar I used to take down to Worthington in Monongah, where I had an aunt that lived down there on Swisher Hill, And so I used to ride that streetcar, take it from my father's store right there where you get on the streetcar, and you go down through Shinston and then Monongah and Worthington, and then it went on to Fairmont.
I don't think the younger folks realized how important those streetcars were.
Oh, yeah.
They were busy, just like trains.
Yeah, I mean, I really am telling my age when if you can remember a streetcar.
I would love to have rode on a streetcar. Now, did your grandfather come here from Italy?
My grandfather and my grandmother both came here. And my grandmother's last name was Balot. And she came from a family of 13. And her father would go back and forth to Italy and bring people back to work in the coal mines. And he managed to accumulate a property and farm and so forth. And at the time, the what they called the Black Hand wanted money from him, and they wanted cattle and things like that. And he refused to do it, and they killed him. They put him on the railroad track out by Menards and he was killed. And all of those kids went with all different relatives. And that's why the name Balot is spelled differently, because they really didn't know how to spell the name. So you see Balot spelled several different ways.
Oh, okay.
You know, and so a lot of like Patsy Treacost's grandmother and my grandmother were sisters. Right. And so a lot of the people that you would know here, because those families were the part of the Balots, those kids were all distributed all over Northview and Broad Oaks, down clear down to Watson in Fairmont.
What year was your grandfather murdered?
You know, I don't know.
Probably
I have to look,
but
I know my Aunt Catherine was probably a baby then, and that would have been Bernard's mother, Bernard Folio's mother, that those people knew here.
Huh. Uh-huh. Now, did you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I have a brother and two sisters, and they're younger than I am.
And where did you go to school?
I started out at Pierpont grade school, and that was on that end, and I stayed there till the fourth grade, finished the fourth grade. And then on the fifth grade, I went to St. Mary's, the Catholic school. And an interesting thing is that when public schools, we did not have music at that time, at least in those 4 years I didn't. However, in the Catholic school, they had music, and so I was expected to read music, and I couldn't read music when I... Well, and so I got a failing grade my first semester in music.
But that's how you were first probably exposed to music, right?
That's right. And so it's funny because I got a failing grade because I couldn't read music. Sister Rose, I believe it was the music teacher. And I didn't know what it just hadn't been taught.
Did they know.
But they had had 5 years of it, you know, or 4 years of it, and
did that kind of spark your interest in music, though?
Well, yeah, it did. I guess I wanted to get even. So, as luck would have it, I end up running the largest musicians organization in the world.
Now, what was the first instrument you played?
Ukulele.
Really?
Yeah, ukulele with Arthur Godfrey had a show, and he sold ukuleles on that because he played all the Hawaiian music.
That was a big thing during the 50s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, where did you graduate from?
Well, I graduated from Notre Dame.
Notre Dame.
Our class was the first class to go all the way through, and I graduated in 1959.
59, okay.
Yeah.
Did you ever listen to the local radio?
Always listened to radio. You know, we turned my brother and I had the same bedroom, and we would turn the radio up, and we would tune into a Nashville station, which was a black rhythm and blues station, and it was 50,000 watts, so you could get it, and so we listened to it, and then I used to go up to WPDX, was right here on Main Street, and I used to go up there and. And I did a couple radio shows as a young kid. They had me singing some songs.
Oh, really?
With Al Newton's mother-in-law. Yeah,
name
was Scoof, and she played bass. And see, radios had a lot of music in the radio stations.
Yeah, Cherokee Sue, Little John, all of those performers.
That's right. And so they actually had. A lot of the original shows, most of the major shows like The Shadow and The Green Hornet and all those shows came out of Detroit, and they had live musical bands, orchestras played for those shows, and I, as luck would have it, I ended up knowing a lot of those musicians that worked on those shows.
Oh my!
And Congress. At a time, they didn't like the idea of having to pay musicians. Now, Congress owned a lot of radio stations, including Lady Bird Johnson did too. And so they actually fought trying to keep music out of the radio stations. And to this day, musicians don't get paid by radio in the United States. on terrestrial radio. We do not get paid. The writers of the songs do. We do get paid in all the other countries of the world. This is the only country that doesn't, because Congress, every year we go before Congress and try to get that. We bring Nancy Sinatra and different people in and try to pass the performing arts radio programs. Because Frank Sinatra, we were giving him an award in Las Vegas. And first thing he did, he jumped all over me. He said, "How come I'm not getting paid for my radio play?" You know, and now they get paid with Sirius Radio and FM, but they don't get paid with what's called terrestrial radio. They do not get paid. We're the only country. Korea pays.
Is that why the little shows that each radio station had, those singers, is that why that sort of all disbanded?
That stopped it because they did something called the Lee Act. They had what was in Congress is that if you went to a radio station and tried to negotiate a contract for live musicians, and they told you get out and you didn't go, you broke the law. If you went back and you met with someone and came back, that was a conspiracy to break the law, so that became a felony. So yeah. And so we had people go to Congress and at least get that part of it out. So we defeated that after a lot of years. We had a lobbyist that worked for us out of Charleston. He was relentless, an older man, and he would go in and just sit in the congressman's office or senator's office until they would see him. And he was so annoying that they finally, Ned Guthrie was his name. Ned was a funny guy. Ned worked for the union, but he used to have a music store in Charleston. He used to have a big band, and he taught trumpet. He played trumpet, and he had a player that a trumpet player would come in, but he started missing classes, you know, because you have a regular class when like to learn how to play trumpet. And he told the boy, he said, what are you doing that you're missing his class? He said, "Well, I'm playing basketball." And he said, "Well, you better put that basketball up because you'll never make any money with that basketball," he told Jerry West.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Ned had Jerry West. When Jerry West lived in Cabin Creek, he would go down to take trumpet.
Well, good thing he didn't take his advice.
Right. And there was a book written about Ned, and that story's in that book.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, take me back, like, you're a teenager in Clarksburg. Walk me down the streets of Clarksburg.
Yeah, well,
and tell me what you remember.
The big thing to do if you were a teen in Clarksburg, go down to the Moose Club. And I think it was Thursday nights, and they had a live radio program. Dick Husted was the DJ, and they would we wore pink pants and peach pants and all, you know, ducktail haircuts and all that, and you go down there, and it was a teenage place to go, and that was always on the radio, and so that was kind of what you did as a teen. And when I was in high school at Notre Dame, they had a, you know, since it wasn't a public school, they had to raise money. And they had, they actually had a minstrel. They did a regular minstrel every, as a fundraiser. And they had me imitate a guy by the name of Johnny Ray Elvis. And they had a live orchestra. And so I would sing those songs with them. And I think in my yearbook, it said Elvis, you know.
Do you remember seeing Elvis on Ed Sullivan? Or Tommy Dorsey show?
I remember seeing Elvis personally.
Really? Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, he was going to play in Charleston, and I was part of the musicians union at the time, and so myself and a friend who also was part of the musicians union, Kelly Castleberry, we were invited up to his suite to spend some time with him, and I saw my first bacon cheeseburger there. He had a big tray of bacon cheeseburgers and one of those gray ice things filled with milk. And he drank milk, and we ate cheeseburgers with him. But what we were talking about were the musicians he worked with, who I became dear friends with, many of those musicians the musicians that he worked with actually started Nashville. It was the Harold and Owen Bradley, and they started in a Quonset hut in Nashville, and they discovered Patsy Cline, who was also on the Arthur Godfrey show.
Yes, that's right.
Right.
Forgot about
and,
that.
And so they discovered Patsy, and Harold and I became very close friends, and I was pallbearer in his funeral when he died at 93, but he was the most recorded guitar player that ever lived.
Yeah. Elvis had some very talented musicians with him, didn't he?
Yeah, that was called the A Team down there that Elvis recorded. That's all the RCA Victor music that was done. And the Owen brothers owned that building, and they still do that. That's still in the family.
Now, when you were a teenager, and was Elvis like your hero then? Is that music that really got
you going? I liked Elvis, but I also liked the blues music, because that's what I would hear on the radio station. And radio station, I remember they would advertise something called Randy's Record Mart, but then they would play basically blues and rhythm and blues.
Who were some of the folks you would buy records?
Jimmy Reed was always someone that I played with. I ended up working with some of his musicians. I'm going to see him next week. I'm going to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We've got a function to do over there.
Now, what did your parents think of you with all this type of music? Were they
They were
supportive of it?
They were supportive of it. And I think and even proud. My mother and dad used to come out when I played different places.
That's
because
good.
All these places that you were talking about, I played. I think all of them. I played every fire hall. And
well, let's mention some of those places, because I'm curious to hear the stories behind.
Well, there's stories behind them, trust me.
Let me mention, let's start with the Blue Moon. It was outside of Clarksburg on the way to Salem, I understand.
Yeah, no, the Blue Moon I knew was across from Bell Meadows.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it had a front bar, and then they had a back dance hall. And the dance hall, there was a back door, and that's where we would load in and out, and we always set up right there.
And what was your group at that time?
At that time, it was the Mason-Dixon Five. And we had some recordings out. We had recorded, but we had a drummer, and he's passed away since, but he was a welder, one of the Swaggers. The Swaggers are all welders here, you know. He was a good welder, worked pipeline and everything. But when he wasn't working pipeline, he played drums for me. And he had the fastest hands of anybody I've ever seen play drums, really fast. And we would play Wipeout, which was, one of the famous songs of the time, and for a drummer particularly. And then we had a little stick that we did when he would start playing drums and you couldn't stop him. I'd take drums away from him and throw them out the back door, and he would end up with no drums. So he'd end up playing on people's tables and on the wall and everything,
Oh, I bet the crowd loved
you.
And
so at the very last, I would pick him up and throw him out the back door. And everybody came to see that. I did it. We did it any time we played there.
Oh my gosh. I bet you were a crowd pleaser.
Well, that you had to be, unless you were working Willow Beach.
Tell me about Willow Beach.
Well, Willow Beach, it started at 11:30 at night. So you could play an early job and then go play there. And I played there at least 8 years, maybe longer. And I got paid $5 extra to help bounce, because I was up on the stage where I could see if any trouble broke out, one evening in particular, there was some trouble broke out, and I jumped off the stage to kind of break it up. They had a regular bouncer, a pretty tough guy named Bob Cathers, and he won the heavyweight championship of boxing and wrestling for the Marine Corps the same night. So I won too worried, except these two guys grabbed me, and one guy ran and hit me and broke my jaws.
Oh my gosh.
And that Monday I had a recording to make in Cincinnati at the same studio that that James Brown used.
How did you get through that?
I had a record out called Backup that I wrote, and the other side was totaled, and I sang it with my jaws wired shut.
Oh my gosh, Sam.
That record, if anybody has it, I saw somebody was looking to pay $85 to get one. It's now called Garage Grunge, and it seems like it's popular in Sweden now. I saw that online.
How about Billy's Meadowbrook?
Billy's Meadowbrook, that was a famous haunt down around Monongah, right off of Swisher Hill on the way to Four States in there. And that was a nice, as I recall, the walls were all knotty pine and everything. And that was a regular place to play. And you had a pretty good band if you could play there. And then Billy's Meadowbrook, but then there was the Melody Manor.
Yeah, Melody Manor is one of them.
Yeah, Delgatti had that. He was a dance teacher. He taught ballroom dancing, and it was a beautiful, beautiful room.
Now, where was it at?
That was in Fairmont.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was there when they actually had orchestras, because they used to have orchestras play a lot of places here. And now, see, the orchestras go back a long time in this town.
Carmichael Auditorium hosted some big bands in their time, didn't
they?
That's
exactly right. Tommy, Jimmy Dorsey, every band you ever, big orchestra you ever heard, which I later met a lot of these people, used to come through Clarksburg and play the Carmichael Auditorium. I would have been like 5 or 6 years old when this was going on, and I'm 83 now. So, that was many years ago.
Yeah, I don't think people today realize how important Clarksburg was to the entertainment circuit.
Well, the Musicians Union here started in November of 1911. So there was obviously enough music here to actually have organized music.
And then you also had the silent films, which many theaters had whole orchestras just to play with the film.
That's exactly right. And I can tell you from the point, I laugh to diverge just a little bit, but this is very timely. People are all anxious about AI, that it's going to replace the, well, what do you think? How long do you think the musicians have been going through this? We had orchestras and at least a piano player in every movie theater. Back then, the Musicians Union of the American Federation of Musicians of the United States and Canada spent $1 million to try to keep music in the theaters. They only kept one. The only one that they kept was in Radio City Music Hall.
They have that
organ player there.
Oh,
but the rest of them are gone.
Yeah, so I don't think people realize that.
That was the original AI for us.
That's right.
Right. And so I helped recently with the motion picture contracts. There was a strike and everything. And of course, I was part of the negotiations. And we worked it out. The agreements that we have now for AI, for as far as musicians are concerned, it's the same thing as multi-tracking, which are when they use several tracks on a film or something, you got to make sure everybody gets paid. That's AI. It was AI back then. Mm-hmm. It's funny that one of them, which I find an interesting story is now, so we have the movies came in. Well, they had to have soundtracks, and still that's a very nice contract. If you can play in the movies, that's your job, and that's regular work, and it's good work. So we were worried at one time that they were going to replace the music that you heard in the movies, because when there was a movie came out called Chariots of Fire, mm-hmm. that was done with all synthesizers.
Yeah, Vangelis.
Yeah, two synthesizers. Well, when they costed it out, those two synthesizers cost more than a 150-piece orchestra. So now what they do, they'll use a synthesizer, and they have a very large room, and you have musicians sitting with a keyboard and a computer screen, and they score all this stuff for the orchestra. They send it to the orchestra studio, to the soundstage, and then they play it, you know, and that's still a regular, that's still a regular job.
I'm fascinated with silent film. What an experience to sit there and watch the film, but have this orchestra playing. You know, it's like going to two different concerts one time like that.
Here they use pianos too. You know, because that was a regular thing.
Robinson Grant had a beautiful organ at one time. Yeah. I wish I could have saw that.
There were four theaters here.
The Ritz. I think the Ritz had a great Wurlitzer in there too, I believe.
Yeah, and they also had large orchestras coming there and playing too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you ever talk to any of those gentlemen that played for the silent films in your lifetime? Have you ever had an opportunity?
I did. I became great friends with a guy by the name of Spud Murphy.
And who was that?
Well, he was a composer. And I remember playing in Leonard Hannigan's orchestra. I'm singing in the orchestra. And they put sheet music in front of me, and I'd read on the bottom, "Buy another Spud Murphy arrangement." Well, as I moved up in the musicians union, I negotiated these contracts. And Spud also was on our negotiating team. He's from Hollywood. And he great fun. But I said, "Man, I never thought I would meet you." And I said, "Now, you wrote all these great arrangements." I mean, he was just a great, great musician, great arranger. He's a good drinker, though. He's a party guy. And he was an older man at the time.
I think when you're in that circle of music, though, it comes around that you're eventually going to meet these people that you've heard
or read
about.
Oh, yeah. Especially like the Desi Lu studio. They used a lot of great musicians, and a lot of them became officers in the Musicians Union in Local 47. That's in Los Angeles. And so I ended up knowing a lot of them and been, you know, pretty good, very good friends with them. But Spud, I was talking to Spud. I said, "Now, boy, all these great arrangements you run." I said, "What do you think when you're gone, what do you think you're going to be remembered for?" He said, "Well," he said, "probably not what I'm most proud of, but," he said, "what I made the most money on." And I said, "What was that?" He said, "Well, the studios asked me to write some ditties." Well, that's just, you know, little things. I said, "Well," he said, "Yeah." He said, "I did pretty good with those ditties." I said, "Why?" He said, "Da da 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 da." He wrote the Three Stooges theme song.
Really?
Yeah. He said, "I made a ton of money with that, and plus all these other things that you would recognize were just little quips that he wrote, and you know, he got paid for them."
Even like the cartoons, like the Warner Brothers cartoons, had great music in them.
It's wonderful music. And to this day, on Fridays, they do all the Fox, all those Fox cartoons. They record part of them in the morning and part of them in the afternoon. That's regular orchestras that play. Now, there's one of those shows I think they also wrote Book of Mormon, that group of cartoons. The studios wanted to cut the orchestra out. And they said, "You can just stop the show because we won't do any more shows. If you remove one musician, we're done." And that's South Park, right? And South Park that's all that music's live. They don't redo it. It's all live music.
Never knew that.
And so all those Fox cartoons are done on Friday afternoons out there, and not in the summer, but during the winter they play this in the morning and the afternoon. They take a break and then they go do the rest of them.
Now, I have to ask you, when you're growing up and getting started in music, were you more of a singer or a musician? What were you mostly doing?
Well, I had played drums and bass and some other things, but I mainly sing. Yeah. I guess I like being out in front.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to mention some of these older groups from around here. And mm-hmm. and if you can give me some stories, if you can tell some of the stories, I don't know.
Yeah.
The Jumping Jacks.
Now, see, I don't recall that name.
The Chords.
The Chords, I do recall. And I'll give you some names of people you can talk to, too. That,
okay.
Mike Audia had a group. And Mike's still here. You know, he's Mike played music. And just recently, Anthony Ellis, he just passed away. They just buried him this last week.
Oh, yes, I remember seeing that obituary.
Right, yeah. He played saxophone. And his uncle taught him, and that was Sam Ellis. And Sam taught saxophone. Sam always carried a mouthpiece in his pocket so he could sit in anywhere. Now, Sam, most people remember Sam Ellis from, he ran the volunteers at the hospital.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And, uh-huh. But he was a great musician. He taught all, he taught all of his family how to play. They were all good players.
What groups was he in? Do you remember?
Well, most all the orchestras, they used a lot of the same people. And so he played at the Green Acres and, you know, with Sam Bettini and those groups. I was in there with Sam Bettini once. Sam Bettini played piano. He was from Wheeling, but he would come down and he would play that. His piano is out at All Saints Church now.
Oh, really?
And you still see cigarette burns on it where he smoked. And, all right. But I was in Green Acres one time, and in comes this guy with a cowboy hat, a little guy. And it was the guy that wrote Tennessee Waltz. He was good friends with Sam. Sam used to work with Xavier Cugat.
Oh, really?
Xavier Cugat had a band. I ended up knowing a lot of his, and I ended up knowing Xavier Cugat. Matter of fact, I have two paintings that Xavier Cugat gave me that he painted. You know, he was on television. He had Abby Lee, I think, and he always had a hot Latin chick singing with him.
Yeah, you know? It was kind of Latin flavored music.
Yeah. But Sam Bettini played organ for him.
Was he married to some movie star too?
Oh yeah.
I can't remember who that was, but yeah. Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to ask you about the Prodigals.
Yeah, the Prodigals, of course, that I would say in my era that was certainly the most popular group around, and I know Roy Davis, Maurice Davis, and of course Gerard Folio played guitar, and Billy Smith played organ, and they had a lot of doo-wop singers, and their songs that they had up was Vangie, Won't You Believe, and Marcia,
Judy,
those four songs, and they were on Dick Clark. And they played a lot. They probably could have done a lot more, you know. But you know, they were young then. You know, it was like
They signed to the Falcon label in 1958.
Yeah, that'd be right.
Was the Falcon a pretty good label to sign to?
Yeah, it was one that was used around here. Like Pee-wee and the Prophets was on that, and. The singer that the Prodigals had was Chuck Collins. I think he changed his name to Troy Parrish and everything. He was just a great singer. And he and I would go record with other groups, and we'd do background singing for them.
Did they have record labels here in Clarksburg? Recording studios to record on?
No.
Okay.
We mostly, I went to Cincinnati and recorded, and also Gateway Studios in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
And you might do a demo here, but you know, you really needed to be in a real studio.
I used to get the WI newsletter, and it was always so interesting to me. And if you don't mind, let me just read this one little memory from Jim Alvaro.
Yeah.
Alvaro. He was WI class of 56. I just love this. He wrote that, at that time in 2008 is when he wrote this. And he said, Billy McCoy works at the library and Teddy Wilson works at the bank just across from the library. and he manages the parking lot outside most of the day, and I try to visit him when I go to Clarksburg. He said the prodigals, those are the prodigals because several of the guys would follow them around. He said, I even sang with them sometimes. I would ride with them to Uniontown, Pennsylvania, where they had a gig there. I remember John Harrison saying I had no business on stage because he said I had a monotone voice, and he was probably right, but I had a blast doing it when they would ask me to come out to the audience and sing with them. He says, sometimes I will sit in my car and play a cassette of four of the songs the Prodigals recorded, and we would reminisce of the good old days, and man, were they the good old days. Does that sound yeah. like a memory you would have?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, there were so many stories about the Prodigals, like they were the band around here.
They were.
They were like really, really, really popular. Now, how about the Esquires?
The Esquires were out of Charleston.
Okay.
And they were headed up by a guy by the name of, I mentioned before, Kelly Castleberry, called him Larry. He played saxophone with the group. And to this day, they still get together once a year.
Oh,
and they have a reunion band. I suppose it's all their kids now playing.
That's nice.
But they used to play, they used to come here and play down at the Carousel. And then after they played the Carousel, they'd come out to Willow Beach.
Now, and where was the Carousel at?
The Carousel was down across from the where the hamburger place is, where McDonald's is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That was a big night spot too then.
It was. It was like, you know.
I had here that they recorded in Pittsburgh with Del Shannon. Does that sound correct?
That's where Del Shannon recorded. I was due to record. I was working with a man by the name of Sassine Francis, and we had a song called "Nice Guys Finish Last" that he wrote, and I forget what the B side was, but anyway we went up there to record. Well, someone was in the studio recording using our time, but they had made a mistake. And Del Shannon was recording there at the
time. And he was a big name for the folks that don't know.
Right.
Can you name some of his songs?
Runaway.
Runaway was a big one.
So he was doing Runaway at the time. Now, songs that do any good have a hook. What's called a hook. There was a hook in that song. It sounded like a train. And it sounded like a train in the background. What happened, they used Ampeg recorders, and they have a head that was left open. And by accident, that head's supposed to be closed on the tape. It's supposed to close down. They left it open, and it was open, and rather than shut it, the sound engineer started cupping his hands over it like that. That was the accident that made that song.
Oh, I'll have to go back and listen to that again.
Yeah, it's called Runaway.
Didn't Marty Robbins have something happen like that to him when he was recording, I can't remember what song it was, but the speaker blew out or something, and they didn't change it, and that made that song. I guess the hook you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. Yeah. You never know, do you?
No.
What was recording like in those days? Was it all on tape? I mean, for folks that don't know, how
well, yeah, you used Ampeg tapes and you had the whole band there. Now, for example, I had two guys come from Miami to have a meeting with us in Hollywood where we were meeting about recordings and things. And these two guys met each other for the first time, and they had over 100 recordings together. They'd never seen each other. And they lived in the same town.
Don't you think a lot is lost doing it that way? I mean, I just think if you're all in the same studio together, there's more.
It's so different now because, you can do anything you want to with the song.
Would you go to radio stations and actually walk in and say, hey, here's my newest record. Would you play it? Could you do that back then?
Is that how you kind of marketed it? That's what you did. Sometimes a $20 bill might be attached to it.
Oh, okay.
that was the big payola thing.
Yes.
At that time.
Tell that Sam, for the younger folks that don't know, that was a big deal back then.
Yeah, I mean, if you got your song played on the radio, that's what it took. You know, that's and still to this day, you know, if you get on Saturday Night Live or if you get to play the Super Bowl, you've made it. You know, I mean, those two shows you want to pretty important to be part of that.
Did it cost a lot of money? Like as a young group, you're a bunch of teenagers. If you wanted to cut a record,
typically, it's not a lot different. Now, I mean, I suppose you can do it on the cheap, but I think any record's going to cost you 10 grand.
How did you guys in your groups when you recorded some of your records? You just work other jobs to pay to have that?
Yeah, we all had other jobs, but and then we may have producers and so forth that worked with us. That be other DJs or so forth would take us. And
when you had records, did you travel very far from Clarksburg to play and promote your records? Like, would you just jump in a car and drive off to Chicago or something?
No, we would have the job already done. I mean. I took a group, the Vanguards. I had the group called the Vanguards, and we left Willow Beach one night and played all across country. We played black nightclubs all the way across country, clear to till we got to California.
Oh my!
Yeah, you know.
What year would this have been?
Would have been like 61. 1961.
Did you run into problems because of segregation? And
very much so.
Can you tell some of
this? Yeah, we had. I can tell you. I'm not bashful about saying it. I'd tell him if he was sitting here. But we had our group. We had John Rice played bass, and Larry Poe, who ended up working the bank, played great saxophone, and Larry Cutler played. Larry Poe, then Bob Cutler played guitar, great blues guitar, and I sang, and then the drummer at the time, I was drummer for a while, but then Eddie Lewis played drums, and he also played bass. Eddie Lewis was a black guy, right? Well, we didn't think anything about it, but the group.
Yeah.
The segregation cut both ways, because we would go to the black club to play, and they'd see all these white guys. I said, "What are you guys doing here?" And he said, "These brothers will kill you. You don't want to come in here and play." I said, "Well, we have pretty good equipment. Let us play one song, see if you like us." But you were on the tape. We sent tapes ahead, you know, to hear. And of course, we never got thrown out any place. We played James Brown stuff and Bobby Bland's music, and so we played all these blues songs. And so, you know, we did all right making it across country playing in all these black clubs. But then when we go to eat at a restaurant, they wouldn't let us in because Eddie was with us. You know, they would do that. Well, I thought when we got to L.A., things would be different. Well, we had a job at a place called Carolina Pines. I think it's still there. It's a bowling alley, but it's a rock and roll place. And we're playing there, and until they found out some of the guys weren't 21, and we had to get rid of it. But we ended up getting a job for Bob Eubanks. Bob Eubanks was the first DJ to bring in the Beatles to L.A., so he made a lot of money.
Was that KTLA?
Yeah.
Right there?
Uh-huh. And so, of course, he had the Newlywed Game. Yeah. Well, he opened three teenage nightclubs called the Cinnamon Cinders. We were playing the one in North Hollywood that we were playing. Well, he really hadn't seen us, this is a teenage nightclub. And we come in and, you know, he's there one night. He called me in because I was the band leader, and he said, "I want you to get rid of the drummer." I said, "What?" And Eddie was showy. He stood up and played drums, you know, and danced and played drums. You know, I said, "What?" I said, You got Dee Dee Sharp in the Olympics. They're all black. He said, "You can either be all black or all white. I don't want any mixed groups." He said, "I don't want any mixed groups." Well, I wouldn't. If Eddie's listened to this, he probably didn't know this. But I said, I didn't tell the band anything about it. I just said we got fired.
Oh, okay. Now, that's hard for younger folks, I think, today to understand that that's the way it was.
Here, you know, we were drawing a good crowd, and I mean, we sounded good, you know. And as luck would have it, Eddie had a cousin that was in a group called the, I think it was the Olympics. Anyway, they had a song out called Young Blood, Coasters, the Coasters. He had a cousin that was in the Coasters, and we met them. And they had a gig with a guy by the had a song out called Hand Jive, and he had a black club, and we got to play there. Eddie got us in there because of the Coasters. They were on the road, so we took their place, and playing in that nightclub, and so we opened for Little Johnny Taylor and Marvin Gaye. That's who we were playing. So we did just fine out there playing that. But but Bob Eubanks called me and said, I like you, so I want you to go play all my three teenage nightclubs. And he had three, one in Alhambra, one in North Hollywood, and one down in, towards Disneyland. And so I'd go with these other two singers who had their own bands. And we go sing whatever we sang, and then we sang some stuff together. And I ended up coming back here because my mother was sick and my wife's mother was sick. And so, you know, I left them and came back, and they stayed together and became the Righteous Brothers.
Oh my, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, you've met some big names.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's who you work with out there.
Yeah.
And, It was harder out there. I mean, if you went 100 miles outside of L.A., you could make good money. If you in L.A., you had the Beach Boys playing for $100, you know, a piece.
Did you ever go into the folk scene, the folk music scene? Did you ever do any of that?
No, not really. I mean, I ended up working with the Beach Boys. I did. I recorded for Mike Love. We became great friends. We lived together in I was gone from here 30 years. I lived in Lake Tahoe, but I worked in New York and Toronto and Hollywood. I had offices in those places. Across the street from me was Mike Love, and that next to him was David Coverdale from Whitesnake. And I mean, we all lived together, and on down the street was the guys from Creedence Clearwater, and we all became friends. We all worked together.
You all love music. I mean,
well,
it doesn't
and
matter
you what... know, when they weren't on the road, the guys from Creedence, the drummer and the bass player, would come play in my band, and then with Mike Love, we recorded some children's music and did things like that, and we produced shows out there. We did a lot of theater for children's theater in the world's largest stage in Reno. It's just a fantastic stage. And we would do, over Christmas, we would do shows like Annie and Fiddler on the Roof and all those kind of shows. We did 18 years of those kind of shows with a live orchestra. You know, we'll use live orchestras for all this.
Now, when you were young, in your younger days, was that doo-wop music that you mostly played, or what would you consider that?
I didn't play doo-wop. The Prodigals kind of did doo-wop. I did more James Brown stuff.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
Yeah, that
for more, the younger folks that don't know, because I we have a lot of younger listeners too. Explain what doo-wop is. What it really is.
You know, you have a back. It started by mostly guys standing on a corner doing a cappella, mm-hmm. You know, so and doo-wop is one of the classic things you hear. Doo-wop, doo-wop.
Would you consider early Elvis Presley music, was that more like rockabilly?
It was definitely rockabilly, yeah.
Because when I listen to his early stuff, it sounds a lot like country rock or something like that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now when he did all the RCA stuff, he used the A-Team, and A-Team, the A-Team would record five, they would do five 5 records in a day.
Wow, that's brutal.
Because they didn't read music. They had what's called the Nashville system. And that's, you throw up 3 or 1 or 5, and that tells you what change to go to.
And I don't think a lot of people realize how Nashville really influenced that early music.
So I can tell you this professionally, that if you take all the music that's recorded in the United States and Canada and put that in one pile, the pile that Nashville has would be 4 times bigger.
I don't think people know that, do you think?
So it's not just country music. They do symphonic music. They do, you know, like Neil Young records there. I mean, anybody that's anybody, you record in Nashville. That's where, I mean, I know because I paid the money out. I know where all the money was. That was my job with the Musicians Union.
Now, let's jump a little bit ahead. Like, okay, after you were done playing music, I think you, were you administrator at Weston State Hospital?
I was.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about that, those years, how you got involved in that.
Well, when I was playing music, that's how I got in public health. I know when I graduated, well, I went to military school in Barnesville, Georgia. It was Gordon Military College, and it was a junior college. And I had a band there, and I had some guys from here. Wally Neely played drums, and Jim Bartlett had the tire shop. He played baritone sax, and then I had Dale Hathaway played tenor sax. They were all in this military school down there with me.
And they were all from here in Clarksville.
They were from Bridgeport.
Bridgeport and Clarksville.
And then. And Bill Miller was one of the background singers, and Paul Suter, they were background singers for me. And we started doing shows at the school. And then we went on we were on some national shows, and like The Voice then, they had these shows, which now the place is CNN. So we did those recordings, and the school liked us to go because we wore our uniforms.
What was the name of your group?
Stripes.
The Stripes.
Yeah, because so we wore our military uniforms and we would go out. And then while we were there, we had a promoter would have us go to University of Georgia or Georgia Tech. This was one of the groups I had down there, and we would go play their fraternities. Wasn't that they liked us. The guitar player we had played with a black band, and they wanted the black band, but they weren't allowed to hire him. So they would hire us, and we would bring the black band. We would open for them, and then they would play.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because they wouldn't let the black bands play there, but they would pay us, and then we'd pay the band, play the other band. That's how we got by, because of segregation. Yeah, you know, so, but yeah, then we came back here, and I went to Fairmont State and graduated from there. And the day I graduated, I played at Willow Beach that night, and I remember hanging my diploma up on the stage. I thought, well, I guess this is what this is about. That was 1965, but I'm still playing music. And as things would happen, I'm looking in the newspaper for a job, you know, for a regular job as a college graduate. Now I got to get a real job. And there was an ad in there from the Centers for Disease Control looking for what called Public Health Disease Investigator 2. And it said, send a resume and down to Charleston, this place. I don't know. I think I was just being funny, but I took a pencil and a Bluebird notebook and wrote why I thought I should have the job. And the guy called me. Pat O'Meara was his name. He called me and he said, I want to meet with you. You're one of three. I've interviewed over 100 people for this job. But I wrote in there that I it sounded like a job was just right for me because I was a musician and I was out at night, and I understand that's the kind of work it was. Well, it became a syphilis investigator,
really?
A public health disease investigator with just checking. The pay was that we had money from the CDC to just eradicate syphilis. Mm-hmm. So I did that while I was playing music, see? And so I probably wouldn't have gotten a job had I not played music.
That's right.
And, you know, they wanted somebody that was not, you know, not a 9-to-5 guy.
And it made it good because you could still play music.
And oh, yeah, it was perfect,
job,
you know.
So
and
perfect.
And I carried blood testing equipment with me. You don't know how many times that people would say, hey, I think I might have a problem. I go out in the parking lot, take a blood test on. Yeah.
That wouldn't happen in these days, would it?
No, you know, I mean, well, no, they still do that.
Do
you know?
They?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm doing that. Well, the next step, you know, hey, you can only do a job so long, then you got to get promoted, right? Well, they wanted me to either go to Africa for smallpox control or to South America for 3 years doing malaria control and working for CDC. Well, I was married and, you know, I didn't do that. So I applied for a scholarship and it was a stipend to go to get a master's in public health. And I was accepted in a master's program or MPH and Nixon cut out the stipends. And so I went down to West Virginia University to see about their health education program. And they said, we don't want you as a student, we want you to teach here. And they hired me so I went to school there, but I was hired as an instructor at WVU.
You were always in the right place at the right
time.
That
was just lucky, yeah. Yeah, I was lucky to do that. Still playing, but I'm still playing music, right? And, you know, as all these things go on, well, I'm teaching at a university, I'm writing grants, and, you know, I became the director of the Clinical Cancer Education Program, which started the Cancer Center down there, because that was a grant that I'd written.
Oh my,
but
okay.
But I was fortunate enough to work down there with some pretty good people, and I'd my doctoral area was educational psychology and curriculum instruction, so I got to meet B.F. Skinner, and his daughter taught there, and son-in-law taught there, so we got to meet him, and I used his work to develop this grant. And because when they called me at the grants department, it's kind of a funny story. They said, you've written some grants, said you've been pretty successful at them. I said, there's only going to be one grant in the country for this cancer program. I said, well, let me see the request for proposal from the year before and then this year. One word was different. The original one said cancer training. The new one said cancer education. Well, guess what? You can figure that out, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So that means they wanted all the big E education, you know, curriculum instruction, educational psychology, you know, instructional technology, all that. So I put all those people together using Skinner's work, and we developed a program down there, and it was successful.
And what year was that?
That would have... Well, it would have been in the 80s.
Okay.
I think in the 80s or late 70s, maybe, yeah.
And then how did you end up at Weston then?
Well, what happened, I got called down to Charleston to go to work down there. And I didn't want to leave the university, because the nice thing about that, I put a grad assistant in my class, and I'd go away and negotiate contracts with the union. I was in 1982, I was on one of the five board members for the United States and Canada for the union, but I was still teaching at the university, so I could do both with no problem, you know, you just have to go 4 times a year, you have to go negotiate contracts, you know, and you have to go to board meetings. And so I went down, and I worked for five governors. It, you know, only two went to penitentiary, so that's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, I worked for Wally Barron, Archmore, and, you know, but the rest of them. And anyway, It turned out that they wanted me to go to work down there because of my labor background. They needed to make labor appointments. And so I ran the Healthcare Cost Review Authority, which had 63 hospitals and 100 nursing homes. And I was told, look, you're not here because of your brains, you're here because we don't want any labor problems in these hospitals. And they were going to close some of the hospitals. And okay. So that was why I was there. Well, the governors were changing and I didn't want to be in Charleston. And I asked the governor, I said, you know, you got somebody up at Weston that's not one of your friends. And I think that'd be a good job for me. And he said, okay. And then it was a political appointment.
And this was the old Weston State Hospital.
There were 39 administrators from 1856 on, and I was number 37. And my job was to downsize the hospital and build the new hospital. And so I got them to move where they were going to locate it and put it on the property that we had right there where it is now, where the new hospital is.
What was it like to work in that old hospital?
I loved it. It was really great. I mean, that's the largest sandstone building in the world, with one exception, the Kremlin.
If no one has been there to see it, you need to just stand on the grounds and look at it. It's so massive and beautiful.
It is. You know, my office was right in the front, and they have great tours down there, and they have three or four different kinds of tours you can go. But I was administrator there, and I take a tour. I learn something every time there. So.
Tell the story, because I heard your previous interview on WHAW with Steve Peters. You told a story about a patient there at the hospital.
Yes.
You had some sort of talent contest or something.
Well, no. We would have. I like history. That's why I'm sitting here. I like history, and I like I like the arts, and. I like English literature and those kinds of things. You know, that's kind of what I like. I don't look like that. That's what I do, but I did.
That's your passion.
Yeah, that's
of
my
music.
Passion. You know, I mean, for example, I was never on the honor roll at Notre Dame because I was always in detention. You know, I was always acting up, doing something, trying to be funny. You know, and. Which worked all right for me because I had to walk home from Notre Dame to Golf Plaza, and I didn't have to carry my books because I'd take my books in detention and finish my.
You say you figured that out.
Oh yeah, so you know, I know it's a long way to get to where I'm going with this, but Sister Irma, I think, was the principal, and she said, "Well, you're coming to senior night." And I said, no, I'm not going to go. I didn't participate in those. I always had to work to put my way through things and play music and, you know, being a caddy and working in my father's store. You know, I always had to work. So anyway, said, no, you better go. Well, here I won some awards. I didn't know because no one knew I couldn't be on the honor roll because I, but I did all right. I was a Latin scholar and all that kind of stuff. But I'd written a poem. And I was just being funny, writing this poem. He's supposed to write a sonnet. Well, the couplet has to rhyme on the end and all that. So I wrote what I thought it was going to get me in trouble because I thought it was probably sacrilegious. Well, they turned it into the Catholic Daughters, and I won the state award, which was $500. Then I ended up winning the national award. That's why she wanted me to come there because that's how I ended up going to college and having winning that. And the story was about Mary and Joseph, and Mary was pregnant, going looking for a place to stay, right? Christmas, uh-huh. Right?
Yeah.
And at the end, you realize the story was being told by the donkey.
Oh, that's a neat.
Well, I thought I'd get in trouble for that. Well, guess what?
It changed your life, didn't it?
It did. And then But anyway, you know, so I was always kind of involved with the music. So because of that, this is the history part, I would go back through the archives at Weston, and they had things written in pen and ink, but they would also make copies of the letters. You know, they were even on that real onion skin, you know, and you could see where they were written. And I recall this one letter. It said, "Dear Mrs. Chisholm," said, "your daughter is doing tolerably well, and she so enjoys the band concerts on Sunday afternoons." And this was from the 1800s. And I thought, we're still having band concerts down there. The Musicians Union, because of records, there's a fund called Music Performance Trust Fund. When jukeboxes came out, they replaced bands. Well, part of that music has to go free and open to the public. They're still doing music down there. I had a band playing there that night, and it was a band I would have been in before, you know, and I knew the band, and they were playing. Well, the patients, the ones that are able, some of them have football helmets on, it looks like, you know, but they dance, and, you know, it's real entertaining.
Responding to the music.
Well, one of the patients came up to me, for the sake of HIPAA, I'll just call him Billy, and I was telling this story down there, and the guy was doing my podcast. I forgot his name.
St. Peters.
Yeah. He knew who I was talking about.
Oh, he did.
Oh, okay. Yeah. He's all, oh, I knew him. Yeah. Anyway, I said, this comes up to me, and he wore a hat, and he always smoked. He was 30 some, but he'd been there since he was a kid. He'd been there. He had a dual diagnosis. And so that means that he had a behavioral problem, but, you know, also had mild retardation. And he said, "Can I sing a song with the band?" Well, I said, "Let me talk to your treatment team." So I go over, and they looked astonished. They said, "Are you sure that was him?" I said, "We've never heard him talk. We know he can talk, but we have never heard him talk." Well, they've been there. This guy had been there longer than the staff, right? This Billy. I said, "He talked." I said, "He asked to sing a song." I said, "Look, I'll get up on stage with him, and I'll cover for him. We have plenty of mics up there, and, you know, if it's all right with you, and it's not, you know." And they said, "Oh no, let's go ahead and do it." So he gets up on stage, and he tells Ronnie Poole, who used to be principal over here, Ronnie Poole. He tells Ronnie. He said, "I'd like to do 'He Stopped Loving Her Today,' and I want to do it in A." Well, that's George Jones' song, and it's not easy. You know, I mean, it's a hard song. And I said, "Okay, let's go." He did it perfectly.
Isn't that amazing?
He did it perfectly. From that time on, he started recovering. I mean, he was never going to be out of that hospital. And so he became, well, where he could do town visits and then into group homes. Every once in a while, he has to go back to a stronger level of care.
That opened up something in him.
Yeah, now,
music.
The only thing we can figure, we had three music therapists there. None of them had worked with him. But maybe one of them in the past had, because obviously he, you know, it wasn't a miracle. I mean, somebody taught him how to do it. I mean, they had not heard him speak.
Isn't that amazing?
You know,
that's a wonderful story.
Yeah.
That should have made your whole time at Weston worthwhile right there.
Oh, are you kidding?
Moment.
That when I first became Secretary Treasurer of the Musicians Union for the United States and Canada, I was responsible for the paper, which was has been in continuous publication since 1896, and that was my first column telling that story.
That's great. I love that story.
Yeah.
So how long were you at Weston?
Well, I was there for about 2 years, and I didn't get along with the governor at the time. But I wasn't the only one that didn't get along with the governor, because there was another musician that didn't get along with him either. His Governor Caperton's, it was just different politics, you know.
That
I was a political appointee, so I, you know, they could they could replace you anytime they want to. But we didn't see, I got blamed for some of the stuff other people did during signboards put up. I didn't have anything to do with them, but somebody with my name did.
So where did you go from Weston? What happened then?
Well, what happened is I became the assistant health officer for the state, which was a bigger name but less money. So I wrote a grant for them and got the Medicaid waiver program started. That's for people that have a problem and before the age of 23 and need nursing home care, either because of an accident or a birth defect, but they're not senior centers. Mm-hmm. But they couldn't. We had to send them out of state because we didn't have the Medicaid waiver. And so I said, well, I can write that. So I did. I wrote that Medicaid waiver program. And I was driving back and forth from Charleston to here and back and forth every day. And I was in a room with a lot of other people that had from past administrations. And I saw that that wasn't going anywhere, you know. So
how did you end up in Las Vegas?
Well, at the same time, I got a call from the then Secretary Treasurer of the Musicians Union and said, have you ever been to Reno? I said, no. He said, well, we got a problem out there. Would you want to be trustee out there take over that local out there? So I went out to look at it, and I called my wife then and said, you ought to come out here and look at this. And I was out there for 30 years.
So you were involved with a lot of the Vegas acts and all that?
Yeah, I did. I was mainly in Reno, but I worked for both. I wrote a grant there. It was called State of Nevada Grant Program, which was money for free and open music. And so I was doing the music and all this stuff. Because what they were doing was taking the orchestras out of the casinos and replacing them with slot machines, because slot machines became popular. Because we had all the major acts came through there, that Johnny Mathis and all those groups would come through, and they'd use large orchestras.
Who's some of the performers that kind of stand out in your mind that you might have a little story about?
Oh, Johnny Mathis, for example. I'm playing golf with him, and of course, that's everybody knows his music,
yeah,
you know.
And beautiful singer.
Yeah, beautiful singer. And I said, I was talking to him about the keys he was singing, and he told me, I forgot who it was, but someone told him, said, look, you're going to ruin your voice because you're singing for other singers. You need to drop down a key, come down an octave. And he did. He went down to an A range, and now he said, I'll be able to sing forever.
I hope he does.
Yeah. You know.
Explain for those that don't know, and I'm not real certain I understand what the union is that you're involved with. What do they do for a musician? What is the purpose of that union?
Well, it's for professional musicians. If you're going to be a professional musician, if you're going to be a lawyer, you need to belong to the Bar Association. Well, we're the Bar Association for musicians. And we do contracts. If it wasn't for these contracts, they'd be playing for $5, you know, mm-hmm. or free or paying to play. And we do video games. We have over 200 symphony orchestras, all the Broadway shows, the traveling Broadway shows, which are Pamphlet B shows, and most of the recording and commercials. All of those things fall under union contracts, and those contracts are negotiated yearly. Some of them go 3 years, some 4 years, some every year. But those you sit down with other lawyers, and because they've got the money, and we want it.
Have they ever gone on strike like the Screenwriters Guild?
Well,
does,
I was in jail like 3 or 4 times for, you know, disrupting. Now, Las Vegas, we had a big strike. The We had a president many years ago, which I was fortunate enough to know, J.C. Petrillo. And because jukeboxes came out, this is back in the days when jukeboxes replaced orchestras. Well, Petrillo said, that's not going to happen. We're not going to make those records for that jukebox. We're going to have to sit down and talk. They had such a strong hold at that time, the union did, they would not even sing the Star Spangled Banner at the ball games. They would not let them do it. Harry Truman called Petrillo and said, J.C., Jimmy Caesar Petrillo. He said, Jimmy, you need to stop this strike. He said, we need to play the Star Spangled Banner at these ball games. He said, respectfully, Mr. President, go to hell.
He told Harry Truman that.
The strike got settled, and Truman came to our convention. He played piano, and Petrillo played trumpet. You know, so I mean, that's how far this goes back. And then I was involved in, like, the only reason the Screenwriters Guild went out first, it was their turn in the barrel. So we alternate all these, like the IOTC, the stagehands, the Screen Actors Guild, the actors, you know, we alternate who goes first. And that sets the plan, because we all have what's called a Me Too clause. So whatever they get, they're doing for the rest of us, because we go to their meetings. We sit in their negotiations, and they sit in our negotiations. And the entertainment unions are more than what you think. The entertainment unions meet quarterly, and that includes the NFL.
I didn't know that.
That's entertainment. It includes the electrical workers, right? And it includes communication workers, because we make the product, they send it. So we're bigger than a lot of people think, because we get together. I mean, to give you an example, which is kind of an interesting story. The guy that owns the Radio City Music Hall and Madison Square Garden has Cablevision. He owns Cablevision. He also has a band, right? He's got his own band. Well, I get a call from Cohen, who was head of the communication workers, and they were having trouble in Brooklyn because they couldn't get Cablevision to sign on to an agreement. And he said, we understand the owner of Cablevision, I'm avoiding his name on purpose, but the owner of Cablevision is going to be playing with Willie Nelson at Farm Aid. He said, can you call Willie and have him not do it? I said, well, I got the number of the bus. I called the bus and talked to the harp player, because he did all the work for him, you know. And I said, he said, well, we'll take care of that. I said, we'll call him, tell him he's uninvited. And, he got mad, you know, and he said, tell Willie I'm going to sue him. Willie said, well, you're going to sue him. He wasn't getting paid. What's your harm? You know, Willie was smart enough to know that. So anyway, make the story short, he signed a contract.
How many years were you involved with as secretary treasurer?
Well, it's strange. It wasn't really because of what I had a lot of experience being on the board and everything, but I had a download music company. And people that owned the company with me, we were part, I don't know if you ever see Shark Tank, Mark Cuban was one of my partners.
Oh, okay.
Right, and I heard him the other day on Shark Tank said, I never get involved in music. Well, I'm the reason why, because the download, our company really was eight times better, it was lossless music, was eight times better than iTunes. And because it just pristine music, and we were really doing well, and then streaming came out and it was killed the business. But I mean, we had $12 million in that company. I didn't, but people that have real money did, you know, like the guy that put together Office 95, he was one of our partners, and then two guys from Creedence Clearwater were part of it, and then Mark Cuban, and you know, so we were going to but what I did is when I was working with the health department, I had the hospitals go to digital. We got rid of the punch cards. I was a digital guy by accident. I was writing that grant I was telling you about, the Cancer Society. I was writing that grant, sitting in the Med Center library, and they were having a demonstration of the internet. And they asked me if I wanted to participate in it. Well, that got me involved in digital and everything. But just by accident, I happened to be sitting there, and they said, come on over, you want to see this, what we're doing? And the reason that the university was involved in the internet at that early stage was because they also had several federal government things. OSHA was down there, NIOSH, the safety thing. And that ended up all being part of the, and some defense work was all part of this internet thing. And so, I became interested in that, and so started doing that. And that's why when I was at the Healthcare Cost Review Authority, we got people to get rid of the punch cards and go to digital. Well, I started with the digital thing, and we had an office in Tahoe, and we were going to the CES show every year, and we were really doing pretty well, but streaming just killed it because you don't use downloads anymore, you know.
Yeah, it changed so fast too.
Well, the union did not. I was in charge of all the record companies for this thing, because I was having them digitalize their stuff. Some of the stuff we would get, they would send us either a drive or something, and then I would digitalize it for them. I would get it all digitalized. So I had the record companies digitalizing stuff too. Because of that, the union was not getting any digital money. And I got elected Secretary Treasurer, and I wasn't even there. And I didn't know it. They said, where are you? I said, well, I'm in Tahoe. So you got to get to Vegas. Well, I said, you just got elected Secretary Treasurer.
How many years did you do that?
Oh, about 12, 15, maybe something like that. Yeah.
So you were out in Reno for 30 years.
Yeah,
and now you're
but
back,
traveled a lot.
But you're back home now here outside
right.
of Clarksburg.
Yeah.
We're glad to have you back, Sam.
Well, I'm glad to be back. I'm glad to see
you. What do you do? You told me you still perform music. Tell some of the places you.
Well, I go out. They have open mic over at White Front on Thursday nights, and I go over there sometimes and play. And every once in a while, I can put a group together. I've got a lady in Scottsdale that I've done a lot of her work. She when she has a party, she'll spend $200,000 for it, you know, but she can afford it. And she'll call me and say what she wants. Like she had her father turned 90, and she says, I want an orchestra that sounds like Lawrence Welk. And so I put together, I had three people in the orchestra that actually played in the Lawrence Welk.
Oh, really?
Orchestra. Yeah. These people are easy to get. So I put together, she said, but I want you to be Lawrence Welk. I said, all right. So I said, but then she told me the dates. I said, well, I'm in New York and I've got negotiation. I can't get out. She sent a private plane for me and flew me there and back.
Do you have any music available that someone can purchase to hear?
Oh, I don't know. You might find stuff on YouTube, maybe. I think some.
Okay, because I'd
YouTube.
Like to hear some of your music.
It's nothing remarkable.
I don't agree with that. Yeah. Well, hey, Sam, unfortunately, I'm going to have to wrap this up. And I just want to thank you for coming by today to the Clarksburg History Museum. I hope you'll come back again.
I'm really interested in what you're doing here. And and since the union's been here since 1911, they're still they may have a lot of stuff in their archives. This might be a good place to house it.
I never thought about that. Maybe
so,
you could give us some.
Well,
names.
Yeah, we talked to. You used to be with the school board, and so Gary Hamrick.
Okay.
So he's president of the union here, and so he would have it. He would have access to all that, and I'm sure it's sitting in a box someplace. So This would be nice to have a display over here.
Yeah, I mean, we're always wanting people to bring in anything they have. We had a lady come in today that brought us a bunch of pictures of her grandfather, and we're just so thankful for that, you know, because we're trying to preserve history around here. And these podcasts, I think, are really important to get an oral history of all of this. So I really thank you for coming by and doing this today.
Well, thank you, Martha.
It was a pleasure. I loved it.
Well, so, we didn't run out of words.
Oh, I could sit here all day. I love it. But I'm just going to close. I close every one of these podcasts with this little thing here. I say, make each and every day count, because you are making history today. So thank you for listening. And thank you, Sam Folio, for coming today.
Sure.
West Virginia mountain melody, there's a new river singing to me. Oh, this time it's wild and free, your West Virginia mountain.